Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and this is The Effect, a broadcast now viewed by more than 20 million people a week around the world. I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us. The President of the United States gave his very first national address last night since attacking Iran. It did not go well. The reviews from around the world are not good. In fact, by the time he was done talking, the fear index, the sense of confidence that this war would be resolved anytime soon was all but shattered. Oil spiked, markets plunged, and countries around the world were left with a sense that they might very well be left holding the proverbial bag. There are few people in the world as qualified to speak about this topic as Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who really needs no introduction. He's a professor at Columbia University. You read his books, you see him just about everywhere, and he's good enough to join us right now. Professor, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
We're going to be breaking this down in parts, but I guess first, I just want your review of the president's speech, given that it seemed to be the antithesis of everything that Jeffrey Sachs talks about that leaders in the West should be doing. Was it? What is your take?
It was very alarming. The whole world got to see a kind of madman on display. And the reviews, as you said, were not good. The main reviews come through the markets. And as he was speaking, literally in those minutes, oil prices were surging because Trump was talking about was absolutely confused. It gave no answers. It only signaled more destruction. Yeah. And by the end of the speech, the oil prices had soared. Then the market started to open, and they are tanking. So these are the first two reviews. Then I was interested. I went to one paper that I read daily, the Financial Times. Mm-hmm. Frankly, it's usually got a pretty anti, well, it's a Russophobic views. The comments are generally not to my taste. Every single comment was, is this man insane? Is he going to drive us back to the Stone Age? Every single comment on that page, which is usually the very pro-Western so-called attitude, was, oh my God. I was surprised. I thought, oh, this is something different for the Financial Times comment section. But yes, the reviews have been miserable. For those of us who watch Trump by the day, this is what we see every day.
Yes.
Of course, he doesn't give a speech like this every day, but he does give a post like this. He says something crazy like this. This one was crazy. For a president of the United States to say, we're going to bomb them back to the Stone Age where they belong. Honestly, we've not heard this talk, even by, you know, some tin pot dictator of some tiny little place someplace, place. This is the president of the United States, and he's got a lot of firepower behind him. There's no doubt about that. But it was crazy. And honestly, it was also, it's weird because we're going to bomb them. We're going to destroy them. They're going to agree on everything. And you guys open up the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes, yeah. I've got that here. This is called the we broke it, let them fix it soundbite from Donald Trump. Let's play this for the professor.
We're in great shape for the future. The United States imports almost no oil through the Hormuz Strait and won't be taking any in the future. We don't need it. We haven't needed it, and we don't need it. So to those countries that can't get fuel, many of which refuse to get involved in the decapitation of Iran, we had to do it ourselves. I have a suggestion. Number one, buy oil from the United States of America. We have plenty. We have so much. And number two, build up some delayed courage. Should have done it before, should have done it with us, as we asked. Go to the Strait and just take it, protect it, use it for yourselves. Iran has been essentially decimated. The hard part is done, so it should be easy.
The hard part is not done. Easier said than done, trying to take the strait. And, Mr. President, if you couldn't do it, why are you expecting that others might be able to do so? Professor Sachs, to you.
Oh, parsing that meandering, weird, incomprehensible, delusional statement is not simple. Where shall we start? First, decapitation. We could have thought that decapitation ended with the guillotines in Place de la Concorde in 1794. Decapitation should not be the policy. We did it. We did it. You didn't help us. We decapitated, as if it's normal to murder the religious leader and the government of another country. Man. Just that by itself should have some reflection. This has become normalized, by the way, by the two rogue states of this world, Israel and the United States. Man. And I do want to bring Israel into this because Israel is a partner in these crimes. But also, Netanyahu gave a speech absolutely as delusional and weird as Trump just a few hours before. Mm. It's really worth listening to. He delivered the 10 plagues on Egypt as if he was the God Almighty speaking. And this is referring, of course, to the Hebrew Bible. But he's like a guy also living in the 6th century BC. And he delivered the plagues, and how proud. And he said, when it came to the destruction of the firstborn, which is the 10th plague, he said, well, we didn't destroy the firstborn, but we did kill all their leaders. This is a madness that needs to be called out. Because honestly, we don't really all want to die at the hands of these maniacs.
Yeah.
And so even before we get to the rest, we cannot have two rogue governments that think it's right to go murder the leaders of another country and then to be so proud about it, the decapitation or the 10th plague, as if this is somehow their messianic calling. It's got to stop. And there need to be grown-ups. Somewhere, there is one grown-up in Europe. Pedro Sanchez.
Mm-hmm.
So he's
good last name, by the way.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, well, this is a family trait. he has said with dignity, this is not our war. This makes no sense. I would point out that the president, Steinmeier of Germany, said the same thing, and then he was attacked in his own media. There are a few European leaders that are not craven sycophants of Trump, but they've been raised for decades to be sycophantic to the United States. It's pathetic. So even when they see this murderous, vile behavior, they can't react to it straightforwardly. Okay, that's just a predicate to the second part of that crazy comment, which was, It doesn't matter for us. Okay, this, by the way, is utterly absurd.
Yeah.
Our oil prices have gone up as much as anybody's oil prices because this dimbo doesn't understand there is a global energy market. And when you create a massive, unprecedented, sudden supply shock to the global market, it affects everybody.
Mm-hmm.
All of American industry is being hit by soaring energy prices. Mm-hmm. You go to the gas pump, Trump's supporters or former supporters, because his approval ratings are plummeting, are being hit by more than $4 a barrel, $4 a gallon gasoline, which is low compared to what Europe is facing, I admit. But from an American motorist point of view, is shockingly high. So the second point that the U.S. is somehow immune to this is absurd. What is true is that some big U.S. companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron, which, by the way, pay Trump's campaign bills, have soaring revenues. But a lot of their owners, by the way, are foreign owners. They're not even American owners. And the American voters are not the owners of Chevron and ExxonMobil. So whatever Mr. Trump thinks Americans are hurting, he doesn't get it at all. He's delusional on everything. And so he misses that second point. Then comes the third part of that bizarre statement. It's so easy. It's so easy. He doesn't even want to have the glory of taking that bow for doing something so easy, because it's not so easy.
Yeah.
And he knows it, which raises another point, which I will come to in a moment. But if a tanker tries to transit, it will be shot at.
Yeah.
And the Iranians are fighting for their survival. They've been told in no uncertain terms, we're going to destroy you. We're going to bomb you to the Stone Age. Don't blame the Iranians. Blame the madmen, Netanyahu and Trump, who are trying to bomb them to the Stone Age or kill all the firstborn or decapitate them or whatever other insanity passes for public policy these days. So it's not so easy. There is no plan. The last 2 weeks have been every general and admiral and would-be expert opining on every network saying, no, you can't even do it. And so, no, it won't just be opened up or happen by itself. And I think a last point is for Trump to make that claim shows some combination of, and it is true, this is, I have to admit, I can't give you the definitive answer on this. Is he completely a loon, or is he just completely an unbelievable, incorrigible liar? And we can't tell, actually, sometimes. Is it delusion, or is it just that the man has no connection with truth, with telling the truth? I don't know. What does he know? He's an ignoramus in most things. I'm sorry to say it. But also, he may or may not believe in this particular instance what he's saying. But everyone else can see it. And everyone else can see that this is just craziness. And that's why the market reviews of this speech were not positive. Now, I've been saying to leaders in the Gulf region for several months, that's your ally. Are you kidding? You put all your chips in with the U.S. I've been saying it in Bahrain, in Qatar, in Emirates, in Saudi, before this latest round, because I like those places. I really do. And Dubai's a really spectacular creation, and Abu Dhabi, and very clever. But don't put your chips in with this. This is crazy. And then the Emirates is talking about, we'll double down, we'll go to war. They will be destroyed, I'm sorry to say, if they try that. So people absolutely need to get a grip on reality right now. And the reality is Israel and the United States should not be launching wars of aggression against Iran. It's devastating. It's illegal. It harms the whole world, and it doesn't work. That's the first point. Second, Iran is not the guilty party in this. Iran is the victim of aggression. Third point is Iran has wanted to negotiate, not for the last week, not for the last month, but for the last 15 years. Iran has said, we don't want nuclear weapons. It's against our religious principles. The Supreme Leader famously, unless someone is living in a cave for the last 20 years, said no to the weapons.
Yeah, put
and the Iranians have been, the Iranians have been pointing that out for 20 years, and they negotiated absolutely not only in good faith, they opened up Iran to intensive IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, monitoring and inspections from 2015 under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And then Trump, as he boasted about it, he ripped it up. Again, completely the opposite of the truth. He ripped up the agreement, which absolutely prevented Iran from getting a nuclear weapon that they didn't even want. And then soon after ripping it up, again at Netanyahu's behest, then they started more assassinations. They're so proud. Oh, they're so clever. They assassinate people. Isn't that clever? Isn't that a way to stay safe? Go kill the leaders of other countries, especially people negotiating with you, which is part of their genius. And then they go bomb the facilities, the nuclear facilities, and they say, oh, they keep saying for years, oh, we got everything under control. And then a few weeks later, oh, my God, we have to bomb again because it's not under control. Netanyahu is a walking disaster for the last 30 years on everything. He's created wars from Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Gaza, West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Yemen. That's all these wars raging right now. He boasts about them. He even said in his speech how he brought down the government of Syria. Excuse me, I can't use quite the language I want to use, but who are you to bring down the government of Syria? Yeah. Who are you to bomb Iran to the Stone Age? Who are you to decapitate the leaders of other countries? Who are you, by the way, Israel, that is not a party to the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, that cheated on the international system to get its own nuclear weapons, that has no monitoring at all, and that dictates to everyone else how the world should be, and is now not single-handedly, because it's done together with Donald Trump, put the entire world economy into a crisis.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, as I look at this, tell me if I'm wrong, I only see two outcomes when it comes to the Strait of Hormuz. One is, clearly, if this thing escalates and conflagrates, maybe somebody in Europe will go in there and try and open up, as Mr. Trump says, the Strait of Hormuz, which is going to cause a bit of a catastrophe in the region and clog it up even more, which would be horrible. The other thing that could happen is they don't, and Iran essentially stands to benefit from this. I was just looking this morning, Professor. They're charging right now $1 per barrel, and most of these ships have about 1 million barrels on board. Some have 3 million barrels. If nobody challenges them, Mr. Trump has created a situation where Iran is actually empowered. And that kind of creates a whole new dynamic in the region, which probably ends up helping the Russians and the Chinese as well. Your take?
Well, just to say, if Iran is collecting this, they need it to build back destroyed cities, because Israel and the United States have been destroying Tehran, Isfahan, and other cities of Iran. Mm-hmm. Of course, not only military facilities, but civilian infrastructure, homes, bombing people, bombing schools, killing the schoolgirls, all the rest. Yeah. So if they collect this, it's a small amount that they're going to need for compensation for the damages that have been done to them. In terms of what is going to happen in the region, I worry about another basic point, which is that the oil and gas fields and the pipelines and the physical infrastructure of the port facilities, all of these are absolutely open and unprotected. You don't make gas fields with anti-missile systems around them. And if the U.S. and Israel do what they say they're going to do, and if it turns out, as many analysts that know more than I do believe, that Iran has enormous capabilities, missile systems and drones remaining, and that is probably the case, which is why the straits remain closed, then we're going to see a physical destruction of the energy supplies of the Middle East, so that the strait will become maybe not the least of the issues, but semi-irrelevant. Because if the oil fields are blown up, if the pipelines are blown up, if the port facilities, if the refineries are blown up, maybe there won't be that much to ship within 4 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks. And Mr. Trump, who is really an ignoramus and a reckless, foolish man, says, oh, these wars lasted 4 years or 8 years. Yeah, what's also true is that in 4 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks, the whole world economy can be put into a multi-year, profoundly deep crisis, thanks to what he's doing. That's not factored in, it seems.
Let me play something for you as well that made me think of a conversation I had with Donald Rumsfeld when I was a reporter and correspondent over at NBC. Here's the president talking about how we have achieved a military victory, in essence, already, which he keeps saying, by the way. Here it is.
Thanks to the progress we've made, I can say tonight that we are on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly. We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong.
I remember once talking to Rumsfeld. You and I have been in this business long enough. I remember doing interviews, and I remember him telling me during the beginning of Afghanistan that he was hitting all of the achieved, purposed goals that they and sites that they wanted to hit. The problem he had at the time was, Rick, we don't have enough targets. We're looking for some more targets. 20 years later, that war was still going on. So this business of we're hitting all the right targets doesn't necessarily win wars, it seems to me, or at least that's what experience has taught me.
I have to say, probably I've been in this even longer than you, because I remember General William Westmoreland telling us the same thing in the 1960s in Vietnam. Of course, then when Dan Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers and we got to read that it was blatant lying also, so it wasn't only misunderstanding, but blatant lying, we did get a little bit of a window into how narratives are made. Look, I think we can reason as follows. Again, I have to do this only listening to military experts and trying to parse out what I can parse out. But Israel leveled Gaza. It took 2 years of, I would say, genocidal action. And they don't control Gaza. They still don't control Gaza. That's 2 years of a very concentrated, small area that they still don't control it, 2 years. I remember in 1999, the ruthless, stupid bombing of Belgrade, the heart of Europe, 78 straight days. And okay, then they got the Serbian government to reach an agreement with them, but that was 78 straight days for a very small target. The bombing of Vietnam went on for a decade. Add in Laos, add in Cambodia. The idea that 4 weeks or 6 weeks of aerial bombing of a country that has been preparing for this for decades, that is nearly 100 million people, that reportedly or purportedly has vast numbers of underground facilities, bunkers, and other kinds of military fortifications, and that is a huge land area and mountainous and therefore protected in many ways, is going to be brought to its knees in 8 weeks based on every experience of the modern world. Makes no sense. It just makes no sense at all.
Let me ask you the final question I think is important, because I know you're going to be short on time and we're going to lose you in a few minutes. But if the goal here was to get Iran to not enrich uranium, which, by the way, when I had a long conversation in Tehran with Mr. Arachi, he told me, Rick, we're not. He said, I said, are you going to give Mr. Trump what he wants? He said, we're going to give him something better than we gave Obama. Less than 3.66 of enrichment, which is what the deal we had in the JCPOA, yes, as you mentioned a little while ago. But if the goal here was to get them to not enrich uranium, to use it for a nuclear weapon, aren't we literally convincing them that they need to do just the opposite? That they need to be more like North Korea and less like a peaceful nation and follow the fatwa of the Ayatollah?
You would think that if there's a religious leader who says, do not have nuclear weapons, the first thing you should do is not kill him. You know, in other words, this has been the basic point. I know it from many conversations, meeting with President Pezeshkian, meeting with the Iranian leadership for years. They have not wanted a nuclear weapon. And when they say, we don't want it, the United States and Israel said, what weaklings, why don't we murder them? That's the approach. So making concessions, negotiating has gotten them killed repeatedly. Now, what is the real goal here? Of course, the real goal is political control. Mm. That's the real goal. You could call it regime change, although now that term has been so degraded and used tragically and laughably by Trump himself to mean we assassinate someone and we call it a regime change. But the point is, the U.S. wants to run Iran. Israel wants to run Iran. They did, by the way. In 1953, the CIA and MI6 overthrew the Iranian government and put in a police state. Yeah. That's what they want. So this is the whole point. They could have negotiated on the nuclear issue. The Iranians were begging them. The Omani mediator said the day before the attack, we've got a great breakthrough. The leadership of Iran apparently was meeting it with the supreme leader precisely to discuss the next steps of the negotiation. That's why they were together that day that Mossad said, they're all together, let's murder them. How clever these people in Israel and the United States, two murder incorporated regimes that are pushing the world to the abyss. And it's important that the rest of the world, that a few grown-ups stand up and say, no, we're not going to be pushed to the abyss.
Is this the end of hegemony or the beginning of it based on the fact that they're now going to be charging only in yuans and crypto, say the Iranians, and they're doing everything they can to destroy the petrodollar, which isn't the petrodollar, guys, like you've been saying forever, the petrodollar is like the foundation of the American hegemony, isn't it?
The foundation of American hegemony has been 750 military bases in 80 countries. Yeah. When you have the military, you occupy those countries that you also house the CIA and other operations. That's why Bahrain, the Emirates, Saudi, they're semi-sovereign because they're host to the U.S. military. That's been the core. If a country wants its sovereignty, tell the United States, time to go home. You're not protecting us. You are almost a magnet for us being attacked. That's how to regain sovereignty.
You're one of the smartest guys out there. I thank you so much for giving us your time. You have been so gracious with your time to share it with us and share your wisdom with us, which so many people seek. So, Professor,
well, great to be with you. Let's do it again soon.
We will. Thank you so much. Two old guys talking about important things. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time. Well, here's what we're going to do. So after a short break, wasn't that amazing? I mean, he really is a smart guy, and he has so much conviction and courageous as well. I mean, he's, a tenured Columbia professor, which puts him at a certain level. But nonetheless, the things that he said, and he doesn't just say them now, extremely consistent with his arguments that he's been making, trying to convince the West not to do the foolish things that it does, that we do, I guess. I'm a part of the West, and they don't listen. All right, when we come back, Cuba. This is personal for me. It's where I was born. Correspondent Donald Corder was recently in Cuba, and he's going to sit down with me and talk about the developments there. As Mr. Trump says, he's going to take Cuba, but the Russians have a different idea for trying to help the people of Cuba. How does this end up? We'll be right back. Don't go away. So welcome back to the Sanchez Effect. I'm so glad that you're there. You know, I would have asked the professor about this if I had a chance, because this is another story that I've been following, which is important to me for many reasons. The story of Mr. Trump saying that he will soon, quote, just take Cuba. Just take Cuba. I'm going to take it if I want it. I can do whatever I want. It's a little personal for me to hear somebody say something like that. I was born in Cuba. My mom, Adela, and my father, Paco, are both from Cuba. I know the history of Cuba. I know the people of Cuba. I know the leaders of Cuba, right? And right now, this is an island that's being squeezed literally to death by Mr. Trump. People are literally dying in hospitals in Cuba as we speak because he's essentially initiated a blockade to try and make sure that their economy is destroyed and the people suffer, just as he did in Venezuela, just as, just as the U.S. policy was in Venezuela, to be more fair, same as Iran, same as they've tried to do in Russia, as a matter of fact. And they're doing it now even more so in Cuba, even though they've been doing it for some 70 years. But seeing this picture that I'm about to show you, look at that. That's Russia, a ship, a tanker sent by Russia that was, in and of itself, a breakthrough. Because what that ship did is it broke through the blockade. Don't kid yourself. The United States had another blockade on Cuba. They didn't want anybody sending anything in there. And President Putin decided, no, we're sending a tanker with 700,000 gallons of oil to the people of Cuba. And it got through. The U.S. tried to stop all other ships, but not the Russian ship. By the way, the Chinese have also been sending some needed medical supplies and some relief and some humanitarian aid. And Cuba's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, says that he is now willing to even negotiate with Trump if he has to. So that's the backstory. Now let's talk about what's really going on in the island. And to do that, I'm joined now by Donald Corder. He is a great guy, great friend, and a hell of a good correspondent who recently returned from Cuba. What's your insight? Where's this thing going? And what's the sense you got from talking to people there?
Well, where to start, really? I mean, the situation on the ground, first of all, I have to say, is pretty difficult. It was a little bit sad to see just how the embargo in recent days and recent months has so negatively affected the Cuban economy, right? Because, yeah, of course, Cuba hasn't received any shipments of oil or anything like that in terms of energy for 3 months since Trump abducted Nicolas Maduro, stopped Venezuela from continuing their shipments to Cuba. So they've been in a tough time. I mean, there's piles of garbage in the street because there's no gas for the garbage trucks to collect that. There's problems with groceries and food distribution because trucks can't go from the farm to the cities where people have to get that food. And in a lot of places in the country, just complete blackouts for 22 hours of the day, no electricity. This is, I mean, the situation has really never been this bad. A lot of Cubans say
And it's been bad.
Yeah, it has been bad.
The United States has been doing this for like 70 years. This is not something that's new.
Absolutely.
The United States has been putting the screws to Cuba forever. Here's Mr. Trump saying now, though, after all of that they've done to Cuba, here's what's coming next. Take a listen to Trump talking about how he's gonna take Cuba because he can. Here it is.
All my life, I've been hearing about the United States and Cuba. You know, when will the United States do it? I do believe I'll be the honor of having the honor of taking Cuba. That'd be good. That's a big honor.
Taking Cuba.
Taking Cuba in some form, yeah. Taking Cuba. I mean, whether I free it, take it,
think I could do anything I want with it. You want to know the truth? They're a very weakened nation.
You know, a normal human being, a decent human being, I hate saying this because he is my president, but you need to say things as they are, would say, I would love to be able to help the people of Cuba. And if there's some way that we can help them, I would like to be that agent of change. That's the way normal people talk. But this language is not about helping. It's about taking. Yeah. It's about, I can do whatever the hell I want to you. The same language he used once talking about a certain part of the woman's body, for example, which makes people think, that's what Professor Jeffrey Sachs was just saying. I'm just wondering, you were there, how are the people of Cuba responding to this kind of language, this narrative that the president is using?
Well, the first thing I thought about it when I saw this statement, and I got to say, I talked to a lot of Cubans, they said that they felt the same way, is that history repeats itself. Mm. This is not the first time that an overconfident commander-in-chief in the United States thought he was going to take Cuba. Yeah. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind for Cubans, of course, is the Bay of Pigs invasion, mm-hmm. which they know as Playa Girón, where John F. Kennedy thought also he was going to take Cuba. Of course, Eisenhower came up with the idea, but he actually deployed it. And that was a total disaster.
Didn't work.
It was a total disaster. Yeah. And the Cuban government was in a less stable, fortified position than it is now. It was only a couple years after the revolution took place. They shot down U.S. bombers with training planes that were armed with machine guns they strapped on the same day. They used some Soviet-supplied tanks that they didn't even know how to drive before that day. And they repelled that invasion of what the Cubans call mercenaries that were trained by the United States in Guatemala. So think about what the Cubans can do now in terms of another president wanting to take the island.
You know, and it's, Don, you know what's funny? I thought about this a lot. I mean, I think about it almost every day because this is the land of my birth. I'm American by choice because I was raised in the United States, but I was born in Cuba. And if you're raised in Miami, you never lose your Cubanism, mm-hmm. you know, or as we say in Miami, el cubanismo, yeah. right? It would be wonderful, actually, if there was a way that Mr. Trump or any U.S. president can somehow consolidate a American Cuban relationship that would make things better for the people of Cuba. Not one where we're just going to go there and take what you have, or you're going to go play by our rules, or you have to be run by President Marco Rubio, or any of those things. But there is a place for some kind of cooperative structure between Cuba and the United States. It would be great if the United States did that and said, okay, we're going to get together. We've got a relationship now with Russia. We'll get together with Russia and help Cuba. As opposed to language like this, which makes it sound like, A, they either don't know what the hell they're doing, or B, they're just going to go in there and take whatever they want. Nobody wants to be treated like that.
Right, and that's been the Cuban government's position all along. Cuba's never said, oh, we don't want to have relations with the United States. They said that they want a healthy relationship with the United States, but yeah. they don't want to do that on the basis of being constantly attacked economically with the blockade and being treated like as if it's a country that has to bend to the U.S.'s will at every corner just yeah. because the U.S. is stronger. They want a win-win relationship that, you know, China talks about win-win cooperation all the time. That's the kind of cooperation that Cuba wants with the United States. But what they're getting in response is hostility. I mean, there's even been media reports that in the current negotiations going on between the U.S. and Cuba that Trump wants to see the president of Cuba out of power. Like, how are you going to tell another country what president should be in power or not? That's just completely undemocratic.
Yeah, and President Canel is a pretty... He's no Castro by any stretch of the imagination. And when I last spoke with people inside the Cuban government, and I had a meeting with them not long ago, they said, we're willing to talk. Yeah. We're willing to talk to Mr. Trump. We want to meet with Mr. Trump. We're willing to talk to Mr. Rubio. We're not about only working with Democrats. We worked with Obama. We'll work with Mr. Trump. I get a sense they really want to.
Absolutely. But, you know, the United States, I mean, we can look at how they've dealt with different situations around the world, right? Let's look at the Iran situation. How did this conflict start? Tehran was in the middle of negotiations regarding its nuclear program when the U.S. and Israel planned a so-called preemptive strike on Iran.
And by the way, you mentioned Playa Girón a little while ago, right?
Yeah, yeah,
Playa
Girón
is what we call the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. It looks to me like Iran is turning into another Playa Girón. It's another failed military effort by the United States. This thing is going horrible. Iran's winning.
Yeah, and it's all based, it's all essentially a consequence of the United States looking at another country and having this sort of American exceptionalist attitude, thinking, oh, we could just do whatever we want with our military all over the world. But things are not that simple. People cannot just be conquered so as simply as the United States thinks they can.
You know what else is kind of weird? I don't know. Here's my take. I believe that if this ship had not been from Russia, the United States would have blocked it.
Yeah, 100%.
You agree?
I agree 100%. Yeah. I think the reason why it wasn't blocked was because for a couple of reasons. Number one, of course, this is a great development that Russia sent this oil tanker.
Yes.
But let's think about
and that's how, enough oil for a couple of weeks, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not that big of a backtracking for Trump to allow one tanker through, and also it allows him to preserve the more friendly relationship that he's tried to establish with Russia mm-hmm. at the same time. So, you know, I think it makes perfect political sense for Trump to let that tanker through. It doesn't make a super huge structural difference in the situation, and he gets to also keep his relationship.
Which proves a couple of things. A, might makes right.
Yeah.
And the only thing that Trump would actually respect is someone with a bigger gun than his.
Absolutely.
And that's why Russia, which has more nuclear warheads than the United States and every country in the world, can do things like this right. by showing its kind of muscle.
Right.
And that's why Iran is being attacked, because they don't have a nuclear weapon.
Right.
And North Korea is not attacked.
Right.
I mean, that's terrible.
And attacking Iran is in complete violation of international law. But Russian officials have also said, I think Dmitry Peskov, the spokesperson of the Kremlin, recently said, you know, we want to see international law respected, but the West just completely disregards it over and over again.
Yeah.
It's as if it's not even important to them.
But I think we're coming to a world soon, and I'm so glad that you and I are talking about this, where countries like China and Russia, with the help of some others, will, and maybe Iran, mm-hmm. in the world that's coming, with the kind of the end of the hegemony thing, countries like this will be able to assert a strength that maybe they weren't able to assert before. I mean, we know during the Soviet era they were able to assert it, but since then, the Americans have kind of been the Mac Daddies, you know? And I think there's now a change a-coming. And I think part of the reason it's coming is because of this fiasco that we're seeing take place in Iran, which the rest of the world is looking at and saying, well, so wait a minute. So your Patriot missiles really don't work. Your THAAD missile system really doesn't work. Why are we supposed to be so scared of you?
I think it has to do with Iran and also Ukraine since 2022. I mean, and think about the big contradiction here.
Yeah.
All of this sort of revealing of the weakness of Western military might, specifically American military might, is all the U.S.'s own doing. If they had not created the Euromaidan coup d'etat in 2014 in Ukraine, if they allowed the democratic process in Ukraine to continue along its way, maybe
you would have had a neutral Ukraine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if they hadn't attacked Iran, they wouldn't have realized or shown the world that Iran is perfectly capable of defending itself. And it's been preparing for this for many years as well. It's been their doctrine. So by the U.S. pursuing this hostile policy, they've become essentially their own gravedigger of their reputation.
Wow. Great conversation. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you, too.
You want to hear some of the things that people think about our show?
I'd be
happy. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
So now it's time for the comments regarding our interview yesterday with Carrie Prejean. Wasn't she amazing? I mean, she's brave enough to speak out at the White House, no less, about Israelis' religious discrimination. Chimera says, thank you for hosting Carrie Prejean to your program and giving her the airtime. Rick, we don't know how you run your show, but it sure drives an adrenal rush. That's nice. Thank you for being genuine, and thank you for being real. That's nice. I appreciate that. I got it from my mother. She was mean, too, by the way. At Cross and Saber says, as a Catholic, she rejects accepting Israel as a litmus test. She's right. As a Protestant, I reject Israel for its genocidal, terroristic, parasitic, and confiscatory actions. Wow, big word. Thank you for making me work. FUT Wittards 1776 says, I love whatever. I love that you're, stop laughing. I love the people of Israel. I hate Netanyahu. He has been the worst prime minister in Israel's history. Fardin Kumarsi says, Rick, you stated that only the U.S. bans free speech in Zionist and Israel. Zionists and Israel, check out Zionist Federation Australia. And then ZPA says, same as AIPAC. And finally, there's Bill Kahn, 12345, who says, who thinks I'm a spy. He says, he writes, my opinion is the Russian-Cuban agent spews hate again. Thank you, Mr. Bill. What do you think of that?
Well, that's quite an accusation, but you should take it as a badge of honor.
Do I have my spook papers here somewhere? I mean, yeah, I'm an agent, maybe more like a journalist. Yeah. Anyway, look, this is great. I'm so glad. Even if you want to say something that is negative about me or criticize what we do or how we do it, or you've got some suggestions for us, please bring it on. You know where you can find us. We're on BitChute. We're on Spotify. Tens of thousands of you tell me what you think every single day on X, as a matter of fact. So we appreciate you going there. And we really encourage you to tell us what you think. And I read it, believe it or not, or as many as I possibly can sometimes. Thank you once again. Thank you, Don, for joining us. And thank you for letting us into your homes. We'll see you next time.